This podcast of Bookworm is a production of KCRW Santa Monica at 89.9 FM and webcasting at kcrw.com.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm happy to have as my guest Francine Duplessis-Gray, and she has written a memoir of parents called Them, which is published by the Penguin Press. Her parents were Alex and Tatiana Lieberman. Alex was, at his height, the head of the Condé Nast Empire. Tatiana was famed in America as Tatiana of Saks, the designer of hats for women, which became de rigueur for fashionable women. But more extraordinarily, she was one of Mayakovsky's three muses. They fled France during the occupation for America, for New York, with Francine. And in a certain way, the book is a story in which Francine is trapped in a certain sense within the story of Alex and Tatiana as an observer, as a celebrant, but frequently without the loving encouragement and support of parents who get involved in the day-to-day of a child's life. So in a certain way, writing this book is almost an escape of sorts from that encasement. Would you say so?
It's an escape from a repressed need to write about them. I mean, it's an escape in the sense that I could not write about them until they had died, and which is a very painful feeling to have, thinking, someday I will write about them, but they have to die first. I think it's very wrong to do biographies while people are alive. They're inevitably controlled, inevitably thwarted, inevitably biased in favor of the biography, or else they're pathographies of the kind that like to expose people, the kind that Jackie Kennedy has suffered. So I got out of the trap of frustration, if you wish, by being able to write this book.
Now, Francine has written several other biographies, but novels as well. Her bibliography begins with the books that she wrote when she was writing pieces for The New Yorker. There's a book about the Catholic left priesthood. There's a book about Hawaii. It was followed by three novels, Lovers and Tyrants, World Without End, and October Blood. Now, you deal to some extent in a fictionalized way with these parents and the discovery of New York by a young woman in Lovers and Tyrants. How does the writing of fiction, which, as you say in the biography, terrified your parents, differ from the act of memoir?
Well, the act of memoir is much more honest. It's also much more brutal. It's because with parents as devious and as self-invented as my parents, one is led by a kind of sense of justice, of let's present them as they really were, which is not necessarily any less kind or grand than they were, but let's present them in their full complexities. And their spectrum of behavior was enormously wide. They could be extraordinarily generous and kind, and they could also be very mean and devious. I mean, I've never known two characters with a wider spectrum of behavior. And I think this is what I try to show in this book, is that some human beings have the strength to have this extraordinarily wide spectrum of behavior, which is eerie and kind of Faustian in its width. And that I could not do in fiction. I think it would have been it would have sounded outlandish. I think it would have been out of measure. I think you can do it in the biography form, because in the biography form, you usually have documents as props, the documents being Mayakovsky's letters to my mother, my mother's letters back to her own mother in Russia when my mother was living in Paris. And she wrote to her mother in Russia all the time, describing her romance with Mayakovsky in Paris. The love letters exchanged by my mother and stepfather. You have these things as props, and they give a kind of architectural strength to the book, because the reader knows, boy, they were writing this in 38, and then these were letters written in 1940, exchanged between my parents, between my mother and stepfather, my stepfather-to-be, which is extraordinary, because here was the whole of France coming crashing down. There was catastrophic history, I mean, catastrophic military defeat in history, and they were writing about, oh, dear, I can't find any grapefruit anywhere, you know. And it's so hard to find gasoline, and these petty complaints going on at a time when the whole culture was breaking apart. So that the pettiness of people also in grave historical moments, and this is kind of lends kind of comic relief to these things. But I think the main thing is that using archival material that's never been used before it gives biography its strength.
Now, as I was reading the book, and by the way, my guest is Francine Duplessis Gray. The book is Them, A Memoir of Parents. Something in the way of counterpoint emerged, but something to me rather frightening. On the one hand, we have biography, as you say, responsible for the passage of time and for the feeling of passing time. On the other hand, you have the writer who, from the very beginning, is making certain discoveries. You had never seen the letters that Mayakovsky had written your mother, and it's on a trip to Russia that you see the letters that she wrote to him.
Yeah.
Now, gradually, what emerges is...
No, I'm sorry, that she wrote to her mother describing the romance, or the letters she wrote to him were probably destroyed by Lily Brick.
There's a Mayakovsky museum that has an archive mm-hmm. of materials about her. And you discover that this relationship with Mayakovsky was probably the passionate event of your mother's lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that the things that you witnessed as a child between your parents, which were extraordinarily cold at times mm-hmm. and courtly and bantering mm-hmm. at others, mm-hmm. that there has been a facade mm-hmm. lifelong between them mm-hmm. of your stepfather, Alex, not wanting to acknowledge either the name of Mayakovsky or that of your father, mm-hmm. and of your mother acting in a certain way as a extraordinary force field mm-hmm. for your father. But that nightmare that any child feels, who are my parents? Do they love one another?
Mm-hmm.
Did they love me? Do they sleep together? Are they passionate? These are the ghosts that emerge through mm-hmm. this book of a story of a child who is not only being sent off to friends of the family, to places, boarding schools, to places for vacations, to couches.
Strangers' living room couches is where I lived for many years, yeah.
Yeah, and discovering not just that what would allow parents to care for a child is lacking, but what would allow them to care for one another in the deep sense that gives a child security mm-hmm. is also lacking and never explained.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that silence, in a sense, that this book becomes about. Mm-hmm. It answers the question, why did my parents never tell me that my father was killed in the war, and mm-hmm. have others tell me?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, the silences have to do with this terrible fear of confrontation, which both my mother and my stepfather had. They could not stand confrontation. You know, it's famous in Condé Nast's lore. He became the chairman, of course, the editorial director of Condé Nast, that he never would do the firing himself. He would hire lieutenants to break the news to Diana Vreeland or to Grace Mirabella that they were no longer needed, which led Diana Vreeland to make a famous bon mot. She said, I've known white Russians and I've known red Russians, but I've never met a yellow Russian before. They were very cowardly. I think their life was based on dread. And it's that kind of dread and terror which creates these silences. My mother's life was based on a terror that she would lose her kind of magnetic hold on a circle of people, myself, my stepfather, her close friends. But she had such a powerful presence that she really had a kind of hypnotic hold on certain people. And she was terrified that it might wane at any time and that she might not make more conquests and more conquests. And my father, my stepfather, his terror was that his power might wane or might not grow. He always wanted more and more and more power over others, over my mother, over certainly his workers at Condé Nast. And it would be interesting to investigate whether most people who are as glamorous as that and as powerful as that in any kind of industrial milieu like Condé Nast Publications, which is a huge publishing empire, whether their lives are that much based on terror. And I think it's a terror which leads to the silences. I'm afraid of telling my child that her father died. What am I going to do? So she finds the babysitter who will do it a year later, you know. And Alex is much more forthcoming and eager to talk and at least towards me, was very communicative. And but not with my mother, because I think it's my mother who imposed the silence. She really couldn't stand talking. She thought talking just destroyed relationships, and she did not want to indulge in verbal exchange. Verbal exchange, of course, small talk, society, gossip, and so on. But about deep feelings, she would say to my stepfather when he approached any kind of feeling of emotional substance, she would say, "Are we going to have another Jewish conversation?" She was not an anti-Semite, but she would use that word when she was talking to him about, let's not get into the depth of things.
Now, another counterpoint that rings throughout the book is that between art, particularly radical art, and commerce. From the enormous watch cries of the Mayakovsky poems, those extraordinary calls to the arms of the imagination, and Alex's mother, who yearned for him to be a painter, a serious painter, a very unusual thing.
Yes.
A parent who wants...
Only the Russians would want that kind of kid for fate for their kids. My child, the artist, my son, the artist. It's the height of...
And I think of the moment that you and Alex decide that you'll go to summer classes at Black Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of the kind of work that's being done at Black Mountain. Mm-hmm. Charles Olson and Robert Creeley, mm-hmm. and Motherwell, I believe.
Merce Cunningham,
John Cage.
Yeah.
So your sensibility as a writer is formed, in a sense, out of an entirely different stock of aesthetic.
It was formed also by a very rigorous French childhood in which I began Latin when I was 8, and I was a very early reader. And then it was formed at the Spence School, which is a very rigorous school. I attended for 7 years. And then it was Bryn Mawr and Barnard, where I majored in philosophy. So I think that I'd had my fill of classical education. And I think the reason I had such a wonderful education, and that was Alex's gift, was that I was able to plump that out and fill that out with the radical avant-garde of the early 1950s, which was represented by Black Mountain. And on top of my classical knowledge of Latin and languages and so on, to go to Black Mountain and have conversations with Charles Olson and Jonathan Williams and Cage and all that, it was an enormously enriching experience.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Francine Duplessis-Gray, author most recently of Them, a memoir of parents published by the Penguin Press. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Francine Duplessis-Gray about her memoir, Them. Now, over the last 10 years or so, you've done biographies, first of Simone Weil, and then not so much of Sade, but of the household, the two women, his mother-in-law and his wife, whose ministrations are about... How do you say it? Training the Marquis de Sade.
Yeah.
It's his mother-in-law who imprisons him. And as I was reading Them, I couldn't help but think, to some extent, that the world that you're describing of women and men is very much like the world of the Marquis de Sade, the haute monde, the attempt to domesticate a tyrant and a monster, the strange sense of decorum and the breaking out from decorum. In this case, a decorum that virtually can't be broken. It's as if these people have so generated the world of fashion that they don't know a world that could destroy it. From time to time, economics causes the magazine to stumble and fall, and there's great amounts, as you say, of dread. But there's a sense of a world... yearning to be broken, you know. Sade is needed.
Well, so you're making a parallel between Sade and my parents, which is very interesting. They certainly were both very extreme personalities, and I am drawn to extreme personalities. My parents were extremely puritanical. My mother, in particular, she was very prudish about her body. She wouldn't show herself naked before her husband or before me or before anybody else. This is very Russian, very prudish. What we call in French pudeur. It's a non-translated word, but closest is prudishness. And she was, my stepfather was less so, but still was quite prudish. And I think they probably had a very minimal libido, so that in answer to your much earlier question, what do kids wonder about when they're growing up, how often my parents make love, it didn't really come to my mind until I was a teenager, but it didn't seem to be. There was no kind of erotic atmosphere in my household at all. It was a kind of an obsession between each other that they had, and was a kind of mutual pact of advance in the world.
You know, Duchamp had made an object for one of his patrons. It was called "With Hidden Noise."
Yeah.
It was a ball of yarn in which was something, who knew what, and this ball of yarn was encased between steel sheets and long nails held the steel sheets together, which formed a stand, and only the patron knew what was inside the encased ball of yarn. And in this book, oddly, I found myself thinking of that figure, that
Of this object.
Of this object, yes. That rattlings from within are throughout. I think that, again, one of the quintessences behind this book is your book on Louise Colette. She was the unrecognized muse of Flaubert.
And the model for Madame Bovary.
Yes. And Flaubert's autocratic imagination is keeping Louise Colette enclosed within a world which is only revealed to us through the letters and journals. My dear, I feel very much as if this book is a prelude. Well, really, it's the climax of a series of works that are about your own emergence, that you've watched the lives of women, controlling and controlled, who have needed different forms of rescue or explanation. And you know, because you are a literate, experienced writer, that this is not a simple thing, that there's no such thing as exploding the shell, or, you know, this isn't the 60s, we're not going to hurl a bomb.
No, but I'm still continuing to be a feminist, some of my favorite writing has been concerned with doing justice to women who have been treated unjustly. And Louise Carle was certainly treated unjustly by Flaubert and by history. She's a much more interesting essayist than she was judged to be, although she was very praised in her own lifetime after she left Flaubert. And I think Simone Weil just didn't have a good biography written about her, given the whole complexity. And these parents are, this memoir of my parents is partly driven out of my own personal need to present them, to commemorate them as they were. And as I said before, to unmask all the deceitful layers of self-invention in which they had wrapped themselves. So you gave me that metaphor of a kind of hidden object inside a big yarn of wool. Each time I'm trying to untangle the wool, and I think that is the biographer's true purpose and true intent and true justification, is to find that treasure.
I will tell you, in order to come to a conclusion, what I think is wrapped up inside the ball of yarn. It's the most hidden thing in the book. I think it's the spirit of Mayakovsky, who says, ultimately, I do not have the love of the woman I yearned for, and I am being asked to transform my poetic creativity into hymns to tractors and to...
He called himself a latrine keeper to the revolution.
Yes.
And that was in 27 or 8, even just during the romance to my mother, that would show how already disillusioned he was with the revolution.
And what does he do? He kills himself. He shoots himself.
He shoots himself 4 months after my mother marries my French father. The marriage occurs in December 23rd. He shoots himself on April 13th of the following year in 1930. And the suicide note, which is addressed Fiem, which means to all in Russian, it's the accusative of Fiem, is in a most amazing document. It says it really is warning comrades that the oppression is about to come. It's suicide, which I look on as maybe the only positive suicide that I can think of in history, because I was brought up Catholic and I'm a lapsed Catholic like so many, but I mean, I still have religious emotions of many kinds. I don't believe in suicide. I think it's only made tolerable by terminal illness of some kind. But he had a terminal illness, which is a psychic terminal illness, which is extreme disillusionment with the revolution he had helped to create. Because he had, from 1905, been a child of the revolution. He was active on the barricades. He began to be published when he was young, and he was in 1912. By 1915, he was established as the poet of the revolution, and this revolution failed him. And so it was a suicide, which is, I'm not sure it's the treasure at the warp of the book, but it is certainly an education in 20th century epic disillusionment.
And idealism.
An idealism. It's a story of disillusionment and idealism. And maybe my book is a book about idealism and disillusion also.
Well, exactly, because it seems to me that yes. There he is. This is the first death in the book.
Yeah.
And this death says, be true to your art, be true to your love, be true to your ideals, and the world that replaces him, the world of appearance, the world of deception, the world of political courting, it's all a world Mayakovsky could not and should not have lived in. And, you know, the world, in a sense, that this book, as I keep trying to submit to you, is in a sense trying to blow up by excavation, by investigation. It's not a simple kind of denunciation. Nothing simple will do. But it is the attempt to say only truth, only art, only love guide you through the labyrinth of the world of deceits and appearances that others will construct around you.
Yeah, except my parents lived in that world of deceit and delusion, and yet they were such lightweights that they never hit thin ice. and their world is such a lightweight world that it didn't probably even have ice, you know. But still, there is a great mingling of affection and resentment in the book, with, I think, affection eventually taking over, which is absolutely normal to a child. You need to read Freud just a teeny bit to understand that that love and hate, or in milder forms, affection, deep affection and resentment, can coexist and do coexist in all our souls towards our parents, and that there is no final catharsis. There's a seminal essay by Freud called Analysis Terminable or Unterminable. And I turned to that essay recently because I was quite annoyed by several reviewers, particularly Mr. Gottlieb, Robert Gottlieb in the New York Observer, who was an affection review, a positive review, but he was saying, you'd think that at her age, she would have exorcised these demons. Well, this is absolutely naive and is ignorant of any Freudian theory to think that exorcism of parents is ever over. You go to your grave still exorcising your parents. There is no, just the way analysis is never terminable. A good analysis enables you to deal with the problem with the exorcism by yourself, and without having to lie on a couch and paying $150 a day to a guy to do it for you. But it is not terminable, and you have to do this exorcism throughout your life, through meditation, through just thought, and through writing books.
I've been speaking with Francine Duplessis-Gray, author most recently of Them, A Memoir of Parents, published by the Penguin Press. Thank you, Francine, for joining me.
Thank you so much, Mr. Silverblatt. It was wonderful.
It was a pleasure. Thank you. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
You can go in books to the land of ice and snow in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com. Keyword Bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now in the book of the mouse.